The first matter on today's calendar is in the matter of the civil commitment of Lawrence Dean Anderson. Counsel, when you approach the podium, please identify yourselves for the record. Counsel for appellant may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Michael Leonard on behalf of the Appellant Commissioner of Human Services. Your Honors, this case is about whether a party is entitled to put on a case before findings of fact are made against it. That's not something I ever expected to be arguing before this court, but fundamentally that is what this case is about. Just to state the procedural posture of the case is to argue why it must be reversed. Lawrence Anderson is a civilly committed sex offender, and he petitioned for transfer to MSOP's Community Preparation Services Facility, or for full discharge or provisional discharge. The Special Review Board recommended denying that petition in full, and Mr. Anderson then petitioned for rehearing and reconsideration of that recommendation before the Judicial Appeal Panel. Hearings before the panel are typically bifurcated, and the first hearing is when the petitioner puts on his case. If he's made out a prima facie case, then the panel schedules a second hearing where the county and the commissioner put on their cases. The panel does have an exception to this procedure for transfer-only cases. Those are generally scheduled for a full-day hearing at which both sides present their cases in chief.
I should interrupt you for a second. Is there any sharing of argument?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Keep going. Sorry.
Certainly. So in this case, Mr. Anderson did seek review of the SRB's recommendation to deny transfer, to deny provisional discharge, and to deny full discharge. So consistent with its procedures, the panel issued a scheduling order setting the matter for a half day.
You might cut to the chase here.
Sure.
I think we understand the procedural background, and I think that the record reflects that what happened on the day of the hearing is in the morning. Was it outside the courtroom or inside the courtroom?
Sure.
The petitioner indicated that he was not going to request discharge or provisional discharge.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe you should take it from there.
Absolutely. So there was some discussion in chambers before we went on the record, and counsel indicated that his client had decided to withdraw the petition as to provisional or full discharge. We then went on the record, and there was a colloquy on the record in which the petitioner, Mr. Anderson, did indicate that he was, you know, knowingly and voluntarily withdrawing the petition as to those two forms of relief.
And were you actually at that hearing, or was there somebody else?
I was, Your Honor.
And so did that tell you then that this was no longer going to be, I mean, didn't that inkle to you this was no longer going to be a phase one, phase two type of proceeding?
No, Your Honor, because we had a signed scheduling order issued by the panel setting this for a full day phase one hearing. There'd been no request to change that, no motion, and either in chambers or on the record, the panel didn't indicate that the scope of the proceeding had expanded. That wasn't surprising because there's a lot of preparation that goes into a phase two hearing or an all-day hearing that, you know, you wouldn't do in advance of a phase one hearing.
Mr. Leonard, on that issue, the respondent points out that your client knows that when it's a transfer only, and I realize that was not learned until the day of the hearing, but when it's transfer only, it's not a bifurcated hearing process. Would that not be the time at a minimum then for you on behalf of your client to raise that issue, whether in chambers or in the courtroom, that since we're not bifurcated, and I'm presuming, I assume the assumption at that point is then we are proceeding at this point. Was there ever any formal, informal perhaps, orally, in other words, request at that time to continue the hearing, to do something in relation to the fact that now you know and your client knows it's not going to be bifurcated?
To my recollection, Your Honor, there was no discussion on that point. It wasn't raised by anyone. I will note that the it is the panel's procedure to do non-bifurcated hearings for transfer-only cases. You know, I think the notice of procedures itself even notes, you know, unless otherwise ordered by the panel. So, you know, although that's the general procedure, it's not a rule of law, and there's an understanding that, you know, a transfer-only case could possibly be bifurcated. It's
the perception, I wonder, Mr. Leonard, is this one of those situations, and that's part of what respondent at least hints to, that you waited to see the end result of the panel decision, and now that the panel decision was favorable to the respondent, then procedurally we should have had our second hearing. So that was the motion for reconsideration, if I require, or the request for reconsideration, which they did, mm-hmm. and denied it.
No, this came as a complete surprise. There wasn't anything strategic about it. It's not uncommon, actually, for a petitioner to voluntarily withdraw a petition for provisional and or full discharge if there's no support for it. I've had that happen in cases myself. I don't recall anyone ever suggesting that that might automatically cause the scope of the hearing that had been noticed as one type of hearing to expand into a full day hearing at which both sides are expected to present evidence.
So you've never had this experience like this particular
No.
scenario where it was transfer only on the day of the hearing and the panel went ahead with the non-bifurcated transfer only?
Correct. Not only have I never had that experience, no one that I've spoken with has had that experience. None of the records that I've poured through have indicated that anything like this has happened before. I'm confident that opposing counsel would have found a case if there were one where something similar had happened.
I thought that there is a case in the record that's been cited in an unpublished opinion in which the, I can't put my finger on it right now, but wasn't there a case? We'll look to respondent to
sure.
respond to that.
I know he does cite two SCAP cases in which he asserts that a hearing that was noticed as a phase one hearing proceeded as if it were a combined hearing. The first of those was actually noticed as a full day hearing, and so it wasn't unusual that there was a decision on the merits following that hearing. Mm-hmm. The second one, which I believe is the Lease case, I think the first was Weber. The second one is a case that I believe was noticed as a phase one hearing. The commissioner moved to dismiss after the petitioner presented his case in chief, and that motion to dismiss was granted. That's my recollection of that case.
So tell me, what was the prejudice to the government?
So the prejudice to the government in this case, Your Honor, is that we did not have any opportunity to present witnesses or argument opposing the petition for transfer. And we had no notice before the hearing that the scope of the hearing would be, in fact, a combined hearing at which both sides were expected to present evidence. So it was only when the decision was issued on September 13th that either the county or the commissioner realized that this would not be scheduled for a phase two hearing.
What about the panel's acceptance of, isn't it 10 exhibits that the government offered?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about that evidence?
That is some evidence. It is the panel's practice, Your Honor, to require the parties to submit witness and exhibit lists in advance of the phase one hearing. And so the commissioner does put those in, but the commissioner doesn't present her or his now actual case until the phase two hearing. The exhibits are offered into evidence, but that's never been considered something that's done in lieu of presenting your case. The commissioner's witnesses are always called at the phase two hearing. And then, of course, arguments happen at the conclusion of that hearing.
So this was a full day hearing, and the petitioner put in his case, and then what happens?
So it was actually a half day hearing, Your Honor.
Okay.
The hearing in this case.
All right, and so what happened after the petitioner put in his case?
So after the petitioner put in his case, the panel, I believe the petitioner rested. The panel asked if there was anything further from the commissioner or the county. I determined at that point that I did not.
Well, by further, what do you think the panel meant?
Oftentimes at that point, the commissioner will move to dismiss the petition under Rule 41 if, given all the evidence, there does not appear to be sufficient evidence that the panel could find in favor of the petitioner. This case, I believe there was enough evidence that I did not feel that I could make a motion in good faith, so I did not move and indicated there's nothing further from the commissioner at the phase one hearing.
All right. Was there any discussion on the record about when the next phase two hearing that you anticipated would occur or would be scheduled?
There was not, Your Honor.
And so you left thinking what?
So we left believing that the panel would schedule a phase two hearing if it did not dismiss the petition sua sponte, which has actually happened in a couple of cases in the last couple of months.
Okay, so although you didn't move to dismiss, you thought that the panel might dismiss.
I didn't expect that it would. Pardon me, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it has happened, you know, a couple of times recently, so it wasn't out of the realm of possibility.
All right. And if you had moved to dismiss, hypothetically, and the panel had denied that, would your experience tell you that the panel would then say, let's talk about the scheduling of the phase two hearing?
Typically, in my experience, the panel doesn't deny the motion on that day, but issues an order some months later, typically indicating that the motion is denied, and then at that point, there's a scheduling conference held.
So there's nothing unusual about the fact that there was no discussion about the scheduling of the phase two hearing?
No. In my experience, no. Other colleagues I've spoken with didn't find this unusual. I will say that going forward, in every case, I now say the commissioner, you know, is specifically requests that the matter be set for a phase two hearing if we're not moving to dismiss. But
on that point, how much before the hearing, scheduled hearing, did you receive Dr. Lovett's report? And the reason I'm asking is it was anticipating respondent points this out, that would at least give you a pretty good hint that there might be a change. And I'm wondering if a better process would behoove you and your colleagues to contact, be in communication with respondent's counsel to see if the hearing's now going to change similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
You see that kind of recommendation.
Right. I believe, and I don't know off the top of my head, but I believe it was, you know, possibly a couple of weeks before.
Okay.
And in fact, we did meet and confer. The panel's scheduling order typically requires us to do that. I met and conferred with opposing counsel, and I think he indicated that his client was considering dismissing the petition as the provisional and full discharge, but hadn't decided whether to do that yet, or it wasn't, you know, he hadn't committed to it. So as of that date, the matter remained at issue, and we filed the meet and confer statement to that effect.
So what's the harm? What's the harm to the government?
The harm to the government, Your Honor, is that the government was not permitted to present its case. We weren't permitted to present any evidence in support of our position. We weren't permitted to argue in support of the petition. And now that there's a binding court order from the panel directing the department and the commissioner to transfer Mr. Anderson to Community Preparation Services and to devote, you know, state funds and resources to doing that.
So where where is Mr. Anderson right now?
So I believe he is still
locked up someplace?
Correct. He is currently still civilly committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program within the secure perimeter, at least until the resolution of this appeal. I understand they are running somewhat of a wait list to get into CPS at the moment, just given the lack of available beds. and funding for the program.
When you brought your motion for reconsideration, the panel gave you an opportunity to make an offer of proof. And you did that. And the panel denied the phase two hearing again. Doesn't that change the posture of the way this case would present to us if you hadn't brought that motion for reconsideration?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the first thing I'd say about that is that not being able to present your case is a structural error because it affects the entire framework of the hearing. You know, only hearing from one side, that's fundamentally changes the scope and the framework of the hearing. And so it's a structural error, and it's for that reason it's not subject to harmless error analysis under Arizona versus Fulminante. This case is also about the credibility of the witnesses. The risk assessor and the treatment report author did not support transfer. The appointed examiner did, and so it really came down to a credibility determination. The primary way that we establish credibility, of course, is to put witnesses on the stand, elicit testimony, and also subject them to cross-examination.
Okay, thank you. Your time is up, but I'll give you an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Michael Hager for Larry Anderson. Just to make a correction, and it's in my brief, the lease case is on all fours with this case. Those are just two cases that I have tried in the last year, the Weber and lease case. That's how I know about them. The lease case, we conferred at the outset, and Mr. Lease decided to withdraw provisional discharge's focus on getting to CPS. That had been noticed, I don't know if it was 6 months, but quite a few months prior, and the decision came out 6 months later. So that was a year in the making for that one morning that we had, and transfer was denied. And I think if you look at Foster v. Jessen, it gets into the differences between a transfer case in a provisional discharge or discharge case. And there's quite a bit of discussion in Coker v. Jessen about what is the burden of production, what is the burden of proof. There's a shifting burden, and it really corrected some of the errors that had been happening on the burden of production. So that's where we get the nomenclature, and I can directly quote that phase one hearing is in a provisional discharge or discharge case where there's the burden to go forward with proof that would prevent a motion to dismiss. Sufficient proof, a prima facie case. Then you go to a phase two hearing where the burden has now shifted to the opponent of the petition. So that, and that gets scheduled separately. In most cases, that's where you get burden shifting, phase one, phase two. With a transfer-only case, they might say phase one. I think they said phase one in the scheduling order here because it involved all three. I'm not sure that it would have said phase one if it had just been a transfer-only case. I don't know. I haven't had a case like that. But in any event, it ceased to be a phase one case when the petitions for provisional discharge and discharge were withdrawn. It was now a transfer-only case.
With respect to simply a transfer case, are you arguing that if the only thing a petitioner is requesting is transfer, that the state has no right to put on a rebuttal?
No, we're not saying that. But we're not saying that their silence, they would be protected by due process and by their silence. We're saying, now the burden, it's very interesting in Foster v. Jessen that after Coker v. Jessen, now talking about transfer cases, it seems in my reading that the burden of proof to survive a motion to dismiss is the same burden of proof to win a transfer. That's my understanding. There might be some wiggle room there, but for the most part, if you're bringing a motion to dismiss on a transfer case, that's going to dismiss the case if there's not a preponderance of the evidence. So it's either way. I failed to meet my burden of proof as well as the burden of production, and they are virtually identical. I'm saying that under my understanding of Foster. So you could defer, as they did, and not bring a motion to dismiss on the production, because that could have been ruled on, well, no, we find that there was a burden of production and there was actually a preponderance of the evidence as to proof. And that's what happened in the lease case. The lease case was, we find 6 months later, there was an insufficient burden of proof. So in this case, then they need to, if they have further evidence they want to bring on in a transfer case, and they can certainly complain that this was not set on for a full day. They can certainly complain that we need to have our witnesses there. But there is no phase two. There is no shifting of the burden. There is simply scheduling more time or saying or speaking up.
Would you agree, Mr. Hager, though, that wasn't learned by the appellant or anybody because you didn't get a chance to at least learn from your client that he wished to withdraw everything except for the transfer only, and that was the day of the hearing?
Sometimes these things happen. I can't recall what my discussions were with him, but with Lease, it was the same way, and, you know, sometimes it falls against us, sometimes it falls with us, but we did a half-day transfer case.
Which county
Lease.
Was involved in the Lease case?
Lease was Hennepin, I believe.
So are you indicating they were ready with their witnesses on the transfer only part?
I think they could rely in that case. I'm not sure what witnesses they brought, but they could rely on their cross-examination. I don't recall whether they called witnesses on that case.
And so your earlier point was if there had been a motion to dismiss for lack of prima facie evidence in a transfer-only case, then arguably they would have got the extra hearing because the court would have taken that under advisement. You presented perhaps your prima facie case, and it would have stopped at that point. And then presumably later a ruling is issued that might then result in a full, normal, transfer-only hearing case.
It's very interesting, yes. If we had met our burden, they would have said, let's schedule this for further evidence. I think that's what would have happened in the Lease case. But here's the thing. There was no argument. There was no discussion. And absent that, it was taken under advisement.
In which case? This case or the
Lease
case?
In this case.
Yeah.
The Lease case I don't have a transcript of, but I do quote the order that we withdrew it at the outset. So there's a due process issue, definitely, if you have a provisional discharge or discharge case and phase two hearing is not given. I mean, how do you even get to a finding that they have met their burden of proof without them putting on their case? But in a transfer case, it's not that way. There isn't, if you're going to use due process, you're saying we have our witnesses that we want to put on and we'll need extra time. And then you say that.
And so are you suggesting that the government should always have its witnesses prepared to testify at this sort of a hearing, because the event might occur that the petitioner dismisses his request for a discharge or provisional discharge, and then the government better be ready to go?
No, I'm not saying that. I think they just need to indicate if they need the time. They should certainly get it. The due process question is all against the petitioner, by the way. We wait a year just for disposition of a reduction of custody. That's a grave due process issue, but we would be waiving that to say, yeah, absolutely, let's take another 3 months or whatever it takes if we need more. I don't think this question is really before the court. I know it helps as the background before the court is whether there was sufficient showing on a motion to reconsider.
So are you in essence arguing that the government waived its right to put on a rebuttal case by just, I guess, sitting on its hands at the end of the hearing here and not saying, well, by the way, don't take this under advisement, panel, because we want to put on our case?
Absolutely, and that's what their own affiant, Melinda Hexum, said in the instances where you make a motion to dismiss or you ask for further witnesses, we've never seen this. Well, this was in the absence of that. There was no communication requesting that. And we think they did not follow what Melinda Hexum typically says happens in that office. I never received a transcript of the proceeding, so I don't know what actual words Judge Higgs said to express that he was taking it under advisement, but he asserted that he had taken it under advisement. And so on a review of a motion to reconsider, we're here to find out, you know, what new laws have been passed or what new cases have intervened in the, but it's a very narrow standard, and there was nothing new that couldn't have been provided. And what we said in our brief is, well, simply a communication in the court could have been provided at that time. And under Rule 115.11, that's nothing new. They could have said that in the courtroom at the time that they wanted more time and they wanted to bring in witnesses. As it happened, they got their offer of proof reviewed, and on the merits of the case, the panel unanimously found that the evidence that had been provided even further satisfied them that they had made the right decision on the ultimate question. But for them to assume, based on some due process, that they could remain silent and expect a phase two hearing when, in fact, there is no provisional discharge or discharge at issue, I don't think they could rely on silence in that sense, as Melinda Hexum agrees. Rule 115.11 says that it has several criteria. One is whether the decision is palpably wrong. And, you know, where you have the entire treatment staff supporting going to phase three. Phase three is even a further accomplishment than going to CPS. There are many people at CPS who have not accomplished phase three. So Larry Anderson is one of the leading people in the institution, and he proved that. Dr. Lovett was impressed. His treatment team was impressed. We had somehow the higher people were not that impressed, and so they challenged this. But
he wasn't going to be on the street, was
no.
he?
No, he's going across the street where there isn't barbed wire, but he's under great supervision. But the thing that he accomplished is he came a long way. It's been 20 years. You go back to the Linehan case, one of the landmark cases where the commissioner said, well, it's 32 months, our program is 32 months. Well, he's been in there 20 years. And he's made progress, and they have programs that work. I've seen them over and over again, particularly arousal management for people with deviancy. And so the people working with them, this was an accomplishment for them. They came and testified. They were cross-examined. So the evidence is certainly abundant in support of the ultimate decision.
You use the phrase the higher-ups. Were you meaning, and I assume was part of the offer of the proof that appellant pointed to, or those individuals that you believe were not working, they were further away from working specifically with your client than the Dr. Lovett and his treatment team?
Well, Dr. Lovett was an independent examiner, but it was the treatment team and the records and just what he had accomplished that persuaded her and I think the court. Chris Schiffer had his own reasons for opposing, and I think it had something to do with the risk assessor from the state had reasons for opposing. The court could evaluate that. This is a specialized court. This is a court that knows it's what CPS is. So therefore, when it was proposed that we get Chris Schiffer on the stand, well, I've cross-examined Chris Schiffer. Chris Schiffer typically does not respond to a question, what do you think of the risk assessment, because he's not qualified to do that, and he just will not go there. So saying that Chris Schiffer could opine about the risk assessing, he couldn't. He's a master's prepared, but he's not a forensic psychologist doctorate, and he does not do that. I know that from my own experience. So adding him, adding Michelle Sexy, who testifies regularly about the lay of the logistics at CPS for the court understood that, and that the risk assessor from the state would was expected to agree with her previous assessment, that was not new evidence either. So there wasn't any new evidence that was offered, really. Chris Schiffer would have just talked about what he had written, and we already had his writing. So there was nothing particularly new, except there was a record that was very favorable, and that seemed to entrench the opinion of the panel, what evidence was supplied. So we don't have any expectation that a reversal up here would cause any different result or outcome in the judicial appeal panel. And clearly, it was supported by the evidence. It was not in clear error.
I have one question for you. In Ms. Hexum's affidavit, she says that she is not aware of any other case in which the panel has granted the petition for transfer following a Phase 1 hearing. Was this a Phase 1 hearing? I mean, once the requests for discharge and provisional discharge were withdrawn, would this still be characterized as a Phase 1 hearing?
That's something I don't know. I'd have to talk to the court clerk about that or Judge Higgs. But I'm saying it was scheduled as a Phase 1 hearing. It probably was should have been rescheduled as a full-day hearing, maybe. But I don't think it's Phase 1 at that point, because the burden of production and the burden of proof are, under Foster v. Jensen, at least very close, if not identical.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
A rebuttal.
Counsel said at least one thing that I agree with, which is that if this was to proceed as a hearing at which both parties were going to present their cases, that it should have been rescheduled as a Phase 1, Phase 2 hearing, or a full-day hearing.
And who would request that?
Typically, it would be the petitioner who requests that, because it's in the petitioner's interest to have the matter decided at one proceeding, given the length of time that often elapses before the Phase 2 hearing. I believe the panel could also do it sua sponte. The other party certainly could request it, but typically, it's the petitioner's petition, and he's kind of driving the proceedings.
Mr. Leonard, would it be safe to say, though, from your experience now and going forward in similar situations, that you would advise Human Services to be prepared for this possibility, because the court, and to some extent in its reconsideration, did consider the offer of proof and seemed to go to the merits of it and analyze it. But if you want to present that, you've now got a pretty clear direction from the panel. We better be ready, and maybe there'll be stepped up communication between counsel, because I assume it's in respondent's obviously interest of his client to keep this thing moving, because unfortunately now because of this, he hasn't moved despite the order. So the point being is we ought to be ready in the event, and especially once you get that, the big signal is you get that doctor, that independent examiner who opines, then you call up your witnesses, we got to be ready to go. Would that be a efficient, perhaps, lesson learned from the process from your client's standpoint?
That might be something we do out of an abundance of caution to avoid anything like this ever happening again. Given the practical realities of the timing, and oftentimes opposing counsel has a difficult time getting a hold of his client, to discuss whether to withdraw in part the petition. I can't say that that would guarantee that this would never happen again. In a recent case I had, actually, the petitioner's counsel had requested that something that had originally been set for a phase one hearing be rescheduled as a full day hearing, and that request was denied, just given, the panel not having time in its schedule, I think, to do that. On the day of this hearing, I assume there were things scheduled in the afternoon, so it just, no one thought that it somehow automatically became a phase one, phase two, or full day hearing just because he had dismissed the petition in part voluntarily.
One follow-up, kind of more of a practical question. Given the, I'll use the phrase snafu, it's unique because everybody says it was a unique end result, but given the pretty credible testimony of Dr. Lovett and the staff supporting that recommendation, I'm curious, looking back, why your client didn't say, well, okay, let's see how he does. It seems like they're pretty confident. He's been doing well. Let's see how he does. He's going to be under significant supervision, nevertheless, despite the transfer. And maybe you don't have the answer to that, but was there some of that discussion? Let's see how he does.
Sure, Your Honor. There's a couple of things I could say about that. First, MSOP does reevaluate, but what it does is it issues updated reports. There's something called the Special Review Board Treatment Report and then a Sexual Violence Risk Assessment. Those are prepared before the hearing before the SRB, and then updated reports are done before the Phase 2 hearing, and then based on those reports, they might reassess. So it just hadn't happened yet. It's not to say that they wouldn't change their position, and that actually happens, with some frequency. So that's
in the interim, has the government done any investigation, any additional investigation to see how this guy's doing and, what the remedy should be?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor, but that's not to say it hasn't happened.
I mean, isn't that your job to oversee these things?
I am, representing.
In other words, you haven't done anything. Since the case was determined.
Sure. So a lot of that is handled on MSOP's side. They do quarterly reports to assess how people are doing in treatment.
And I'm sure they've done that now, and they've come up with some kind of a remedy, have they?
I guess
we're wasting a lot of time, or you're wasting a lot of time.
I guess I don't see it that way, Your Honor. I mean, I represent the department in proceedings before the Judicial Appeal Panel, and, based on the evidence they had at the time of the hearing, the decision was made that the department did not support transfer because two of the three people who are actually qualified to opine on the statutory factors, or at least some of the statutory factors, had determined that transfer was not appropriate. Dr. Lovett had a different opinion, but the clinical director of MSOP, Chris Schiffer, opined that transfer would be premature, as did Dr. Lauren Reed, the risk assessor, who conducted an actuarial risk assessment and determined that the risk presented by Mr. Anderson was too high for him to safely be transferred to CPS.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. The case is certainly interesting. It has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.